Hello, fellow podcast travelers. Welcome to Saybrook Insights, a production of Saybrook University, an online, nonprofit, private, regionally accredited university headquartered in Pasadena, California. Celebrating 50 years this year, our humanistic approach to online education has resulted in thousands of alumni the world over advancing the health and well-being of the communities we serve. My name is Nathan Long, University President and host of this podcast. Today, we feature 2005 psychology PhD alumna, Dr. Ginger Charles. In this episode, Dr. Charles and I discuss her background as a police officer, her research and current work reshaping policing culture, and ways in which police departments and communities can come together to effect positive change. To learn more about Saybrook University, visit us online at www.saybrook.edu. And now, Dr. Ginger Charles. Dr. Ginger Charles, welcome to Saybrook Insights. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Dr. Long.
As luck would have it, we have a phenomenal alumna joining us today who has committed much of her research and life's work to the study of policing and spirituality, along with policing culture. And she is on faculty, and I'll let Ginger give us a little bit of background about herself. So Ginger, would you mind introducing yourself a little bit more fully to our group? Where you're at now, what you've been up to since you graduated from Saybrook, all that good stuff.
Okay, since I graduated, I decided in 2013, I graduated in 2005. I decided in 2013 that it was time to leave policing. I thought maybe I could help policing if I was outside of one organization and able to access other organizations. So I came to California, got tired of the cold weather in Colorado and crime scenes at 30 below and 3 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, well, I'll just throw my hat in and see if I can get a job teaching. In the meantime, I was still doing a lot of research. And what was interesting around that time, around 2012 or 13, my research partner, Jonathan Smith, who's in the UK, when we were researching and talking with police officers, we started hearing some interesting changes or distress as they were talking about maybe their spiritual practice. There was something else going on inside the culture that we weren't quite sure what it was. But then it really became pronounced when we started to see these incidents of violence against marginalized communities. And so in 2014, we started looking at culture, and then I specifically started delving into, you know, what is really going on here. In 2015, obviously that increased. I was working as an adjunct professor at Modesto Junior College in California. And at that time, I thought, I have got to write a book and bring attention to this. And one of the things I wanted to bring attention to is what is actually happening in the police culture. I don't think there's ever been, I think it's really important to show what it looks like inside because it's been such a closed society. And so I started really researching these shootings and these incidents of violence, and then wrote the book, Police Pursuit of the Common Good, published in 2016, and then continued working on what is actually going on. For the most part, what I can tell you is it's a deterioration of that culture. There's a lot of dis-ease in that culture, a lot of anxiety and depression, and that creates anger and frustration. And of course, we see violence, and we will continue to see violence.
And how timely your research was at the time, and I think even more so now, as you reflect on the recent events over the last 2 weeks with the murder of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. You know, at base level around policing culture, at the national, state, local level, how do we start to affect some change there? And is there a bipartisan way to do that? Is there a way for us all to come together to get behind this in a meaningful way?
You know, it's unfortunate. It's so unfortunate that these three individuals had to be subjected to this type of violence. But I really think that's the bipartisan way. I think that those particular instances were so graphic and awful in nature that it is beginning to turn the tide and a tipping point. So it's not just the communities of culture that are seeing this, but it's actually the white communities that are saying, okay, wait a minute, there's something else going on here. And so I think that we're starting to see that ramp up. I also think that it was a opportunity, a wake-up call for many in law enforcement that have been suffering in this culture of oppression and racism to maybe say, I can't do this anymore. And I need to say something. So then you start to see police chiefs and sheriffs taking a knee or hugging a protester or really starting to engage in the community. And when you see that and the expression on their face, I really see hope and happiness when I see this interaction. And so for me, it's a glimmer of hope that that they're starting to see that this actually is the feel good and what we should be doing in the world. So that being said, that's one way. So police also need to, and this is bipartisan, all police need to take a look at what have I done in my career? What am I actually doing in my career? One example is Camden, New Jersey, and the former chief, I'm not sure what he's doing now, Scott Thompson. When he got that job, he actually made every officer and himself reapply for the position when he became chief. There was such a horrible relationship with community, he decided to start over. So he made every officer reapply and himself. He made officers live in the city. And that totally shifted that police department to being more community-based and more in touch with community. There was a solid buy-in. Compare that to Minneapolis, where I think it's 94% of the police officers live outside of that city. So there's absolutely no buy-in. So you have officers that are basically transient. They come in, they work, and they leave, and there's no caring or connection to that community.
I see. Interesting.
So that's another way. Then the final way I would suggest, not the final way, but the third way, is community actually going forward and saying, you know, this is unacceptable, and demanding that police meet them. And let them know this is how we want to be policed. This is what we need.
What does that look like? I mean, I guess it sounds like one of the key ways communities can affect change is talking about that very thing, is how we want to be policed. What does that conversation look like? And what are some other ways that communities can engage in that change that you're talking about outside of the police department so that communities themselves collectively can start to affect change?
So one of the interesting conversations that I had when I was researching for my book was with a young Black man who was so kind to teach me. And I asked him the question. I said, this is normally not asked. How do you want to be policed? And he was surprised and he said, wow, no one's ever asked me that. He said, I want to be policed from a distance. So he made that statement. I can remember just being very curious, well, what does that actually mean? That goes against everything that we know about policing. And then in listening to the George Floyd memorial, when Reverend Al Sharpton was talking and said, get your knee off our necks. And I thought, that's exactly what he's saying. So this is exactly the concept. We want to be policed from a distance. In other words, teach us how to effectively take care of our own communities. Don't be so oppressive in our communities of in our culture. It's like, you know, hovering over so close that we can't breathe, which is again so illustrated in the last few days. So I think that's the biggest thing, is working with police in order to take care of their own communities. That is extremely important, and they're very capable. We do not need to be over on top of somebody.
What are some other ways that communities can affect change within police departments?
Well, as much as they don't want to, I think the more that they can hear and listen to what it's been like for policing, that would be very, very powerful, because right or wrong, police are on the defensive now. And, you know, they're human beings behind that badge. And so they can be just as damaged as somebody that they're coming into contact with who is in crisis. And so understanding that maybe there's not enough training and arguing for more training, such as somebody not completely capable of handling a domestic violence situation, or somebody that's in the midst of drug addiction, or somebody who's homeless. If that officer doesn't have that training and is depressed and anxious, you're not going to get a good result. Mm-hmm. So the community actually seeing that there are human beings meeting each other here and working with the police on that too. And that's a lot to ask, you know, when you have a oppressive force coming at you, it's going to really take a lot for the police to certainly let people in and explore who they are as human beings.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think it leads us into the next question I have for you. And I want to circle back to the point around policing at a distance in a minute, but there's been this obvious call over the last couple weeks. And in particular, the pitch of it has increased exponentially the last few days around defunding the police. And I think this is one way in which some communities, such as in Minneapolis, I think San Diego has passed an order, if I'm not mistaken. I believe LA County is thinking about something similarly. What does defunding the police mean from your perspective? Is it good? Is it bad? Is there what are the considerations involved in that? You know, I think just kind of broadly, what do you think the impact might be on policing in general?
So with Minneapolis, you know, if you take a look at, I mean, I've been interviewed by NPR 6 or 7 times, and they've had this consistent problem throughout their police department. It's obvious that there's a tremendous amount of racism within that agency. I can't tell you that I would be against completely disbanding that police department and starting over. Now, what happens on the backside of that? What happens to the violence that needs to be responded to by somebody who can take control of that? I don't know. I think that's the community and the other layers of government that need to take a look at that. So in that case, I certainly understand a complete reworking of that agency. And that's not defunding, that's dismantling that police department and starting over. That's not the case for every police department. So in other police departments or sheriff's departments, you have a lot of social problem programs that end up in the police hands, such as homelessness, some would say domestic violence, addiction issues, truancy issues. And so those become a police function when other places in our government can't handle that. So what happens is we fund the police department for those issues, but we don't really provide training or very much training around that. So then you have police that are trying to handle these issues because there's money being given to them. And that's really what defunding is about. We're taking those funds away from specific social problems that could be handled someplace else, probably in a better manner. I know that there are some that want to go so far as saying, well, there's not an armed cop that needs to respond to the domestic. In some cases, maybe that's the case. In many cases, in my experience, that's not the case. You do need an officer there because there's violence is going on. Normally somebody's armed. But for again, you know, that could be a case by case situation. So that's usually what they mean by defunding a police department, is taking a look at the problems and how do we move that into other areas of our social structure. And the problem is that those other areas then have to be responsible for taking care of it. Mm-hmm. You can't say, okay, all social workers are going to handle domestic violence without giving them training and tools and all that, because then it falls back to the police again.
That's right. That's right. So it would be fair to say then that in the Minneapolis case, you have the issue of dismantling the police department, which isn't really connected to this defund movement at all, which is a great clarification, I think, on your part. The defunding piece is really extracting those areas which could be managed by social workers, psychologists, counselors, maybe even public educators or other administrative types who could deal with those types of issues in a meaningful way that police just aren't capable or trained, to be fair, to handle. Is that accurate to say?
That is correct. That is correct.
And I think it resonates with what the former Dallas police chief was saying. They've run his interview on CNN and elsewhere a few different times around, you know, listen, we're not trained or really capable of managing the mental health or social issues that are out there, that we're trained to stop, to cease those types of behaviors and to protect the community to the best that we can. So that's a fair point.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a scholar in this area, but also I know you have a lot of work you've been doing on international policing as well. And your focus has been on looking at kind of that cross-cultural global approach to policing. What are some lessons then that are out there globally where it's done right or being done well that maybe we could take to apply to our institutions around the country?
So it, just as a comparison, my research partner and I were discussing the what's gone on with the protests here versus the protests over in the UK. And he was explaining that most of the protests were very, very peaceful and the police had a completely different approach. There were no police present. They were completely out of that protest and let that protest happen. So again, you know, that circles back to, okay, well, that's at a distance. That's letting that protest go on. There were some cases of violence, but it was relatively minor in the scheme of things. The other issue too is that there isn't the same kind of racism in our policing here as there is back there. Our history, unfortunately, is tied to that in this country. So that's one of the difficult things about our policing.
I mean, you would say it exists, but it's just the context is incredibly different, is what you're saying.
Right? Correct. You know, there's the issue of slavery and Jim Crow and all of that that's systemic within policing. That's, you know, really when you look at how policing started, that was to criminalize slavery. And so when we abolished that, that's what happened is that took over. And so that's different than in the UK. The other issue is guns. You know, if you look at the UK and the fact that most of their police services do not have guns, they normally sign a contract saying they don't want guns every year. And they believe that they're macho because they don't carry guns, which I always find really fascinating. Whereas we feel macho because we do carry guns. And so if you think about a culture, we have a culture of guns. Now, what? How do we correct that? I don't know how we correct that. I think, you know, with the Second Amendment, that just sets some people just completely on fire. So we can't even have this, just an interesting conversation about, well, what does that actually look like? So there's so many differences and we're so unique. The other thing that is hard for us too is that we have over 16,000 police agencies, law enforcement agencies, in comparison to say the UK, which is one body of police services and then branches within that. So there's more control over their services than there is say here in California versus Georgia versus Mississippi or New York. And so that's very difficult to control. And that makes it very, very hard to put in some really beefy, this is how it's going to be. You're not going to do this.
Yeah. So. But we're hesitant as a country. I mean, I wouldn't even say hesitant, resistant to any sort of centralized or nationalized approach. We're so local control focused and based, right? That I think that presents the problem. So you hit the nail on the head with regard to identifying part of the major problem there is that decentralization. I was impressed. I think you and I had talked about these very things several years ago. And when I met your colleague over in Devon, Cornwall, and I had the privilege of meeting their entire police department, it was the the most incredible thing to what you were just talking about, to walk into a police department where not a single gun was carried anywhere that I could see. Now, maybe they had them somewhere or someone had them, but, you know, they brought me in. They said, hey, have a seat, you know, and have a cup of coffee. Let's have a chat, you know, a tea, anything else you need. Here's how we do our policing. And they did talk about the challenges, right? So, you know, violence is still present. I mean, in any society, it's there. I think there is sometimes the concern. I don't want to misrepresent the individual statements to me, but that there is some desire to have maybe more weaponry available in violent situations. So, you know, because of the how things can escalate so quickly, but by and large, as he even said, it's a lot more manageable across the country in terms of, you know, just kind of the totality of dealing with violent situations and policing in general. That's very cool. I appreciate your insights on that. So kind of pull all this together. I know we've been in different spaces here. What does a positive policing culture look like according to Dr. Charles? If you had your magic police wand, what would this look like according to you?
There would be a great amount of conversation between police and community. One of the things that I strive for as a police officer during my career, and many thought I was crazy for it, was living in the community that I served. Everyone knew I was a cop. Everyone. I mean, even my dry cleaner, because, you know, I have a hand that sits a little further out from my waist where I carried my gun. And that's okay. You know, I am there in service of community. So I think we need to take a look at if we're going to have guns in our culture, which I'm sure we are. We have this gun sitting between us. We can't just put it in somebody's hands and not provide any kind of training around the psychological or mental aspect of this is just a tool and you need to talk to somebody. You need to be able to share who you are and not be afraid that you can't share with a community member about, you know, maybe some concerns or vulnerabilities that you have. So a police agency would look like much more open, more of a mentorship, somebody who actually is taking somebody from the other side of the line, the lawless side or the chaos side, and bringing them over, encouraging them over into the order side of functioning in society. Not punishing them, not committing violence on them, not slamming some kind of behavioral trait on them and saying that they're bad and we don't want anything to do with them. We have got to recognize in policing that these are human beings that we're dealing with, and we are human beings. And as it may sound corny, but really, when you think about it, we are in service of a community, period. That's why you have the badge. Somebody hands that to you from the community. It is not this, you're not militarized. You are not a part of an army. And as bad as things get, you know, your job is to go out there and try and educate and encourage people to be lawful and caring for one another.
It's a dramatic shift in messaging and tone in philosophy than even one of the recent news clips or newsreels I saw of a gentleman who does police training, and it's all about you have to be ready to kill. You are a predator almost. I mean, I think that's even the phrase he used. And when you imbue that type of philosophy into your police force, what you just said cannot happen, I don't think. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but you're at odds, you're fighting with the community you're serving rather than in service to, which I think you put it beautifully. It's very well said.
You know, I know who you're talking about. I actually met him, and that kind of training, it has no place in policing. You know, for goodness sakes, you know, there are many of us who do police this way or have police this way. They may be hidden, or it may be so dysfunctional that they don't dare take a chance on exposing how much they care about the community. And many of them have felt like there, but for the grace of God go I, and there is a human being there that I can take care of. and maybe make a difference in somebody's life. You know, maybe that's the only thing they need in order to turn it around and become successful in their life. There are many of us that do that, but a lot of them are hidden.
So I guess the final question, and in connecting back to the protests and the issues around George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and the long list of African-American men and women who've lost their lives over these many years. As someone who studies this issue, and as also, I know in your past work, you've also talked a lot about implicit bias training and the need for that. Kind of globally speaking, how are our police departments doing in that area of not just diversity and racial sensitivity training, but actually doing that work, and how do they get better at it? And I think part of the answer lies in what you talked about with community policing, but I think there's probably, you have some other thoughts I know you've shared in the past with me around how to manage, not manage the issue, but how to get better at it as a community, as a group of police officers, as departments.
I think the first issue that has to happen is this real honest look at a chief or the higher ups, an honest look at what is actually going on. And I will tell you that there are many agencies who feel like they don't have a problem. They don't have a contentious relationship with community. I would challenge that and say, have you asked the community? Can you tell me from that community that you don't have a contentious relationship? So that's the first thing. What is that honest look at? I can tell you that I have had deep conversations with people who said, are you telling me this is racist when I do this versus this? And I'm, yes, that's racist. And not understanding that because they brought in color, a color of a person that changed the way that they looked at something, that's, they just didn't understand that. And so there needs to be some serious and thoughtful training, and that training cannot be done by other cops. They need to open the door and let folks that are educated on the field that they need to work on help them with this particular topic. And those cops can't poo-poo that. They need to seriously look at, okay, I need to really understand what this is. There needs to be more education within the police department. Like, what is actually happening to me physiologically with my body around stress? How am I acting? And then there has to be encouragement that we can say something when something goes wrong. There has to be encouragement for others to come forward when something goes wrong in a police department. I know I struggled when I reported on officers and how I was looked at. I would do it again. It is very clear to report, you need to report when there's bad behavior. When you look at the George Floyd killing and those two officers had been on the job 4 days, one of them was on his legs and said, I don't think we should be doing this, and was dismissed and then continued. There has to be a change in the culture. And just to consider that, you know, Chauvin was an instructor, was one of the FTOs, is horrifying. So those things really have to be looked at. Police are going to have to really look at what they're doing and how they're coming across to the community. They do not have a blanket immunity to be able to say everything's fine, we're good.
So really hard look, bringing people from the outside in, being open to that and really digging into the training and the education that's being offered are some of the key steps there. Those are great prescriptive suggestions, I think, for helping our institutions of policing move forward. That's very good. Yeah.
I think I would just add one thing. I get very, very tired of hearing, oh, they're just a bad apple. It's the barrel. And so that culture being the barrel needs to be looked at. Mm-hmm. It's not just bad apples. We can make bad apples in that barrel. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have to take a look at the culture.
Wise words from Dr. Ginger Charles. I thank you for your time today. I think we'll have to leave it at that, but we're going to have you back in the coming weeks and months, and I hope we can bring some of your colleagues along the way with us. So
My
thank
pleasure.
You.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.